Hey everyone, it's Nate from The Vinyl Guide, and I gotta tell you about GrooveWasher.com, the best record cleaner for your vinyl. Now when it comes to record cleaners, I have used them all, and many of them do an okay job. But when it comes to vinyl and the quality listening experience, the GrooveWasher does the best job. You know, when comparing to other record cleaners, the difference with the GrooveWasher is really between VG and Near Mint. You need a great record cleaner, and GrooveWasher is simply the best. Ask for the GrooveWasher by name at your local record shop, or go to GrooveWasher.com and get the big GrooveWasher bundle. Here's a 10% off discount code, VinylGuide10. Enjoy the full sound of your records. That's GrooveWasher.com, discount code VinylGuide10. Use the GrooveWasher, hear the difference. So now, let's start today's show.
Hey, what's happening? This is Phil from Caspian. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Oh, well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for spending some time here with me talking about records here on The Vinyl Guide. I do appreciate it. And I'm going to crack right into it because I'm very excited about this week's episode. I've been waiting to share this for some time, and I'm pleased to finally be able to do so. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we have Philip Jameson of the band Caspian, a group that I was introduced to by my late friend Dan Brown, and I've really come to enjoy all of their works over the years. They are an extraordinary band. Caspian's new album, On Circles, I feel is their best work yet. It's the next step for the group. They've taken their learnings from some 15 years on the road and making music and really developed what I feel is a wonderful album. Now, if you aren't familiar with the band Caspian, I'd strongly encourage you to check out, just start with the new album, On Circles, start there. I also enjoy Dust and Disquiet, Tertia. They've got an extensive catalog of albums and EPs that is well worth seeking out. Just about anything from Caspian is a really great listen. And another great thing about Caspian, they are a very vinyl-friendly band. I mean, this is a band who makes music that is the kind that you really need to focus on and you want to pay attention to. It's not something that you have on in the background or, you know, you put on, you go empty the dishwasher. This is a band whose music is best enjoyed really with full attention and ideally on the vinyl format. And alongside the normal streaming and CDs and those sort of things, Caspian releases their music with limited vinyl runs of like 150 of one color or 300 units of a different mix. And when it came to their album On Circles, they put the first vinyl run up on their webpage, caspian.band. However, that first vinyl run is now totally sold out. And luckily, I got in early. This interview took place just when the album was about to come out. I sent updates on the Vinyl Guide socials, so if you follow me on those, you may have gotten word and may have been able to get in on one of these pressings early. I've also uploaded a vinyl unboxing video of the latest Caspian album, On Circles. It's a beautiful package. There's embossing, there's different color variants and things like that. So check that out on YouTube. I've just uploaded that as well. Now, fortunately, Caspian has introduced a special tour pressing of On Circles. So if you missed the first vinyl run, you're still in luck. Apparently, it's a splatter pressing, which sounds very cool, but you gotta go see them on tour to pick up a copy. Their website, caspian.band, has all the tour dates there, and what a show they put on. Go see this band, grab a copy of the vinyl, and enjoy. And finally, if you enjoy this discussion, make sure to check out some of the other episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast, including episode 191, featuring Espen Willems of Monolord, discussing the band, their rare records, and more. That's episode 191 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 158 features Isaiah Mitchell of Earthless. Episode 156 features Cody Willis of Big Business and the Melvins. Episode 147 of the Vinyl Guide, we talk to Ken Andrews of the band Failure, discussing their vinyl record history. Lots of rare pressings and 45s and stuff in there, so that's episode 147 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 132 with Greg Pucciato of Dillinger Escape Plan and the Black Queen. We talk records, vinyl pressings, and a whole lot more. Plus, there's another couple hundred episodes available of The Vinyl Guide at thevinylguide.com. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we are ready to roll. Let's start The Vinyl Guide interview with Philip Jameson of Caspian.
Hello,
Mr. Phil Jameson.
Nate, how's it going, man?
It's going good. How's your day been? It's the end of your day, beginning of mine.
Yeah, where are you at, man? Are you West Coast?
East Coast, Sydney.
Oh, yeah. That's very, very East Coast. Yeah,
the other East Coast.
you guys, free and clear down there, or what? Fires.
Look, thanks for asking. The fires were closest to Sydney around December, and then they started moving kind of around the city, and then they're closer to Canberra and Melbourne now. Fortunately, over the last few weeks, though, we've started to have a bit of a change in the weather. It's been getting a little bit more rain, so I you know, knock on wood, I think we're starting to kind of have it under control. But yeah, it's not we're not free and clear yet.
Oh, very, very, sounds very harrowing. A lot of the footage is just unbelievable. So
I know. I mean, some of the pictures and stuff, it doesn't even look like it's on this planet, you know, just what the sky looks like and the sun. So, yeah, it's pretty dreadful. But thanks for asking. And
yeah, man.
Well, look, if the audience hasn't already figured this out, I'm talking to Phil Jameson of Caspian, celebrating the new LP on Circles, and it's going to be a big year for Caspian. I can feel it. Are you guys strapped in? You ready to go, Phil?
Yeah, we're ready to go. You know, we've been anticipating this for 5 years now, and it's been just, you know, it's been a really long process. So to kind of see some dry land here and getting the year set up and organized, it's been busy, but it's good to sort of be back in the saddle and charting a course forward and sort of getting ready to get out there and campaign for this thing, you know? So we're really excited. Hope we can get back to Australia. I'm sure that, you know, as is customary for us, we'll definitely be hitting the road heavy for this record, and we'll get all out and about. So, yeah, it's exciting, man.
I see 2020 is pretty much, you know, the first half of it is clearly planned for you guys. And I've heard the new album. It's stunning. Wow. Not a lot of instrumental works can really affect me emotionally the way Caspian does. And it's not just On Circles, but past works as well. But just coming back to On Circles, I sense a jump in production values, perhaps a less meandering, less exploratory, a quicker and more economical way to strip me to my core. Am I sensing this correctly? Was there a major change in the band, or at least the way the album came together?
Well, you're spot on. First of all, that was certainly one of our goals here. Like we set out with Will, the producer for this record, which was the first time we've worked with Will. We set out collectively to try to make something that just felt a little bit more human, more alive, definitely more concise, sharper, leaner. You know, it kind of goes back to this central, I guess, if there's so many different ways to approach that question. Just in terms of boots on the ground and, you know, the way we handled it as just, you know, musicians in a studio. We did a lot of pre-production for this record with Will, which we've never done before. So, you know, we had a week with him where we were sort of tearing the songs apart in the studio. And we were actually, for the first time in our long 15-year career here, we were much more open to receiving outside ideas. Usually when we go into record a record, like we have every single second of the record mapped out. We have the sequence, we have the song titles, we have the album title. And when we get into the studio, it's all about just deploying all those ideas the best we can, making sure we're working with someone who can capture our tones well, facilitate the process, and kind of traffic cop it. So, you know, when we did the last couple records with Matt Bayless, he did that really well. We had a, you know, a fairly stubborn vision for what we wanted to accomplish before we even pressed record on that thing. This time, I think, and this, I guess, leads a little closer to the esoteric element here. It's like, we were just trying to do something a little bit less precious, for lack of a better word. I think it's sort of this experiment that we're kind of flirting with this ego death, where we're trying to just, you know, we take what we do very seriously. And when we get together to write music and record it, like, we're 110% committed to making something that we're proud of. We take that real seriously. But in terms of taking ourselves and our ideas with the kind of credence that we've had in the past, I think we tried to ease up on that a little bit. And Will was the perfect person to collaborate on that vision with together, because he's unbelievably talented. He's really positive presence. That's wonderful that you were able to ascertain that. I'm really curious, and you're one of the first people I've talked to who's actually heard the record, and I know I'm going to be talking to more people who have heard it. So that's great that you're picking up on that. And some of the people that have heard it have said the same thing. So kind of feels like mission accomplished, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah. Well, this episode's going to come out after the record's out, so everyone will be able to hear it in real time. But it feels like it's, you know, Caspian music, and I go back a ways with you guys. It seems very highly instinctual, but in a collaborative sense, which means an extraordinary amount of trust between the musicians. Mm-hmm. And to now bring another person in, like you said, Matt was the guy who facilitated your vision, but you guys still controlled it. Will comes in and he's closer to a collaborator than a facilitator. What was it that encouraged the band to, I guess, take this moment to open the kimono to someone else?
Yeah. Well, so much fueled into that. I mean, where we were emotionally, you know, we had come off of touring for Dust and Disquiet, which, you know, was for us thematically, obviously a really heavy record, just because it was rooted in so much, you know, grief and sadness over the loss of our bass player, our former bass player, Chris. And then we went and we toured that record for 2.5 years. We had some, you know, amazing shows, and we got to go to all the places that we love and see people that we love. And, you know, we hit it hard, but we were definitely sort of gassed out at the end of that. So we took a year off. We took a hiatus, which we had never done before. One of our guitarists went and hiked the Appalachian Trail. During that hiatus, we parted ways with our founding drummer, Joe, amicably, I'll mention. And then when we reconvened, you know, we had to take some emotional inventory. We had to take some, you know, sonic inventory. Like, what is it that we still love about music here? So we've just been doing this for a while. I think one of the things that, you know, we didn't necessarily talk about this a lot with each other, but it was definitely felt. It's like one of those things that we love about music is that, sir, I think you mentioned the word instinctual. When something happens in a moment, okay, and it's a bit more of like a spontaneous occurrence where you come across something that you weren't expecting in the songwriting process, when that happens, when that sort of apparates out of nowhere, that's when we're the most fired up. So if we're going into a studio with everything totally planned out, you can diffuse the process from whatever magic it is there.
You close yourself off from these happy accidents.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's all we really wanted to get done with Will when we were doing this pre-production together. Like, we spent a lot of time writing music. We came in armed with, I think, 80 minutes worth of material, and we just slowly shaved it down with him over the course of a week. And we gave him demos a month before coming in, and he really, you know, interrogated those demos a lot and threw them up against the wall. Didn't make a single suggestion that we weren't into, which was great. And then, yeah, when we got in there to work on it just before recording together, you know, we stumbled across a lot of things that just sort of gave the songs a different perspective, and just made them more exciting. So then when you start recording and tackling stuff, you know, you're not employing all these things that you've been thinking months about. Like, you're doing it a little bit more on the fly. And I think that, I mean, it's strange, but I always think of things like, even my head's weird sometimes, but I think about, like, just the physiology of playing music, like the things that are rattling around in your head And then the way that those sort of manifest themselves in the way you strike a note or a chord. Like, I think that all of that is kind of swirling around. And I'd like to think that everything that we sort of employed here with Will contributed towards something that did feel more instinctual, a little bit more human, a little bit more alive, a little bit more dynamic and deep. Right. So yeah, it was a great process, man. We're really, you know, it was cool too, because you can spend so much time on a record, and then when it's done, you're happy to have it in the rear view and you want to move on to the next thing. But I mean, we wanted to get back in there immediately and just keep working with them on something. So it was a really positive experience.
Yeah. Cause I guess when you take a break, like you guys have, and even though it's been 5 years between records, it's probably two or three between tours and really kind of working with the band. I guess there would be that potential to create music, but then use that time to overthink it, maybe overbake it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How do you guys ride that line in terms of when you develop an idea, do you come to the group with that idea? Do you develop that idea organically between you? How does the music of Caspian really kind of, what's the genesis and how does it evolve?
It's a good question. It's hard to explain, but I'll definitely take a stab at it. I mean, most of the time, a member of the band will come in with just a small seminal, like kernel of an idea. So someone will come in with a chord sequence, and that chord, there's something about the chord changes that are interesting, whether it's the meter that it's in, the way the chords are playing around each other. That person will play that figure and we'll all just be in the room. Someone will find a melody. We'll start playing with the melody over the chord changes, for example. And then, you know, everyone will just start attacking it from, you know, with their sensibility and, you know, deploying what they do well, but also, like, I think one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons we really enjoy playing music together is that we're pretty lucky, especially on guitars, to have this kind of chemistry where we naturally, when Aaron, Johnny, Cal, or I pick up the guitar, we do something totally different. Like, we all have really different sensibilities, but there is that chemistry there that allows them to sort of exist together. And we don't have to talk about it. We don't have to kick the shit out of it. We can just sort of let it, it's really natural. And I think we're lucky to have that. So the writing process is really using a lot of that chemistry in real time in a room to just sort of see what we can come up with. So sometimes we're lucky and we can, you know, some of these songs we were able to get the bones for and really have a, you know, a solid foundation within a couple of days. Some songs, you know, took 6 or 7 months to really assemble and get to a place that we were happy with. But yeah, I mean, it's an organic process and it starts with someone bringing in an idea that sort of fires up something in everyone's mind. And then we just sort of chase it. And sometimes there's tons of discussion. Sometimes there's some arguments. Sometimes really just not a whole lot is said. Everyone just kind of does what they do naturally. And we're lucky that it ends up working, you know?
When you have an instrumental band, I would imagine that there's a lot more room for interpretation in terms of song meaning and really personal meaning to it. I mean, if you have lyrics, you know the song is about a girl or a car or Reagan or whatever, right? But if it's instrumental, that can mean so many different things, even to people in the band. Are you all on the same page when it comes to the meaning of a song, or can there be large differences?
That's another really great question. I don't think so. I don't think we're all necessarily on the same page. We definitely don't. The formative point for a song, that moment of inception, is never like someone throws out a mood or an emotion and says, let's write a song about this. I think we're all, again, as musically different as we are, we're also just personality-wise and emotionally, we're all really different as well. But we also have that sort of similar chemistry that we have musically, emotionally, which is great. So everyone kind of, I think, yeah, to answer you, like, the short answer is no.
Do you talk about it, though? I mean, do you say, here's where I'm coming from, or here's how this makes me feel?
Not like, yeah, if something is exciting and especially, that definitely sneaks its way in there sometimes, but it's probably 10 or 15% of the process tops. A lot of it's just like hands in the mud, shovel, like just digging musically to see what we can do. And Yeah, there's also something about that if a lot of bands do that, I think that's great. I think an element of that for us would be kind of demystifying. So, yeah, not necessarily.
Do you all come from very similar musical backgrounds, or is there a lot of diversity in terms of like your experience and the music that turned you on as a kid?
Tons of diversity. I mean, I grew up listening to Led Zeppelin and lots of classic rock, and you know, Yanni's coming from like a sort of hardcore punk background, and then Aaron was kind of, he's a classical guitarist, so he was informed by a lot of that. He was also informed by a lot of straight up just 90s FM hard rock. And then Cal's coming from like a, certainly an Americana country place, but you know, he also has a voracious appetite for all styles of music. And Johnny is from DC, and Johnny's got a straight up, DC hardcore Discord thing going on. We really all came from different places, I guess. There's probably bands like Radiohead where we all converge. Like, we're all major fans of Radiohead. We all appreciate Tool a lot. There are a few bands that we can center around, but yeah, we're coming from really almost drastically different places.
Were you raised in the era of records or tapes or CDs? Like, what was in your house? What were the records the music that turned you on as a kid?
Yeah, I'll tell you, man. Like, when I was growing up, I had some records, and you know, I love the ritualistic element of just dwelling with a record. But my big thing was bootleg cassette collecting. I don't know how familiar you are with that underbelly or that sort of that genre of collecting, but it's a trip. Yeah. So I mean, in high school, I just pretty much exclusively spent all of my time collecting live Led Zeppelin concerts on cassette. So this was like dial-up AOL era, and there were some message boards, and there were some really like proto websites, newsletters that, you know, not a lot of people were tapped into, but there was definitely a community of people there. And, you know, you would trade shows with people, and you would just, you know, you would make your own covers for stuff, and you would sort of talk about like the source where like the tape generation came from, and you would then put it in a manila folder and you'd mail it to someone. And you know, I remember coming home from school and running to the mailbox, and if I opened the mailbox and there was that like, you know, padded envelope in there, it would just be the greatest day. Like the greatest day of my life. And then if I opened the mailbox and there was nothing in there, I was just impossibly sad. So yeah, I mean, I think my collection, I think, got up to something like 450 cassettes. I still have them all, and I'll probably be buried with those things, but like, that's where I was coming from. And then, you know, I got into sort of Brit rock, and I started collecting a lot of bootlegs in that. And then finally, when I got into post rock, I started collecting a lot of live Godspeed, Black Emperor, a lot of live Mogwai. Then started just doing this and forgot all about it.
Now, post-rock seems to be a bit of a catch-all term, but it's almost like a near prefix for Caspian. You know, you read post-rock band Caspian. What's your reaction to hearing the band so closely associated with the term post-rock?
It's changed so much throughout the years. You know, in the early days when we were much more possessive and probably, you know, we were incredibly ambitious, and like every young band that's really chasing it, you know, you hate to be defined exclusively by anything. And it's also part of that, you know, feeling very precious element of yourself that I alluded to earlier. So, I mean, we would bristle at it back in the day. At this point, I mean, not to oversimplify it, but we just don't really seem to care as much. Maybe we've just accepted that mantle there, and that's fine. And, you know, of course, if you compare us to other bands, like that's where we fit in here. That's where we sort of slip into the overall picture of music.
They're not going to put you in the country western section.
No, yeah, they're definitely not. Even though we do have some mandolin on this record, we're still not going to get the country tag, which is fine. So, you know, I think people have a natural tendency to not want to be singularly defined by anything. It's like you either, you know, want to be defined by one thing exclusively, and that's your entire life, or you sort of eschew that. And a lot of what we did back in the day when we were more possessive was try to rid ourselves of that. But at this point, we've made peace with it, and it really just, I don't know, the music kind of speaks for itself, so it doesn't bother us as much as it used to.
So you're coming from the position of a diehard Led Zeppelin fan. To me, that seems to resonate quite well, because the music that you create really requires the listener to set aside what's almost near universal music rules of, you know, verse, chorus, verse, and traditional instrumentation and chords, and really, you know, thwarting these sort of expectations and developing an alternative path for musical expression. It's certainly the road less traveled. Is it difficult for you to disregard all that, I'll call it cultural submersion, and forge an alternative path?
That's interesting. I mean, one of the things that attracted us to this style of music initially, you know, when we started the band, was that ability to the freedom to just not be hogtied to, you know, certain structures or to use an instrument in a certain way. Like that was really motivating for us at the onset of this. So I think whatever remains of that is something that's still really exciting to us. You know, and I guess, you know, when we write songs or we put together records, I don't know if this necessarily directly answers your question, but if we're ever at a dead end and we don't, you know, there's nothing that's really sort of inspiring us, I think we'll look back on our old catalog and be like, look, we wrote a song that went like this on the last record. Let's write something that's completely different than this. Let's approach it from, you know, let's do that song, but like structurally, let's do it in reverse, you know, or let's take this part and throw it here and throw it there. And
that's contrarian perspective on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's freedom. You know, that's sort of that liberty that you get with this to make your own rules and chart your own course. And that is still really exciting. And, you know, too, if there's a couple songs, especially on this record, that we want to put vocals on, and like a song on the last record, we'll do that. And we won't feel any obligation to be, you know, attached to, of course, the post-rock thing is, you know, unfortunately always exclusively associated with instrumental music, which, you know, it certainly wasn't coming from that back in the day. But if we want to add vocals to a song, we feel like we can totally do that. And that's part of the thing that keeps us exciting. If we want to write a 4-minute, you know, attempt at a pop song, we can try to do that, which we did on the last record. And if we want to write a 10-minute, you know, crescendo opus, we can do that too. So the fact that it feels like there's no rules with this is exciting. And I think that's probably the number one thing that's kept us excited about doing this, is that we kind of feel like we can just do whatever we want. You know?
Now you've recorded the songs. After they've been recorded, perhaps when you're on tour, how much do the songs evolve after they're recorded?
Like structurally?
Structurally, but the approach, like, do you like to revisit them?
Structurally, the songs pretty much stay locked tight. And a lot of that is because we do have to use some, we try to use as little as possible, but we do use some backing tracks on some of the stuff, just because one of our members doesn't tour with us. So some of his stuff is definitely in these tracks, which are to a click track, and then we can't really extend or shorten or condense sections. So structurally, it stays fairly rigid. Of course, like the big language that we're trying to communicate here is what we're doing with guitars. And there are certain nuances and there are certain like approaches or tones that like will evolve over the course of a tour with a certain part of a song. Well, we'll just get more comfortable playing something. And if you play the same part 20 or 30 nights in a row, you know, you want to stay true to the integrity of the part. But there might be some subtle like nuances or phrasings, or again, like you might just try out a different pedal for a certain section that gives it a totally different color or a different feel in real time. And that's kind of fun, you know? I always wondered what it would be like to be in one of these jam bands, you know what I'm saying? Where it's like any night something can happen. I think that's exciting as hell. But we're not very good at that at all. So
yeah.
We don't have the patience for that, you know.
It's also a risk. It could go either way. I used to do comedy. You have your set material that you're comfortable with, and then, well, in the middle of a set, you start to go off the reservation, try some new things, and it's you need a bit of a safety rope to get you back if you get in trouble.
It must have been exciting, though, right? I mean, because you could just throw yourself out there and, you know, you start drifting. What was that like? I mean, were there times where you were just so far out there that you had no idea like which end was up and then you just you blew it, or did you always find a way back?
No, there's times where you just like, oh, I completely caked it this evening. And I still remember those. There are times you ever have a thought in your head and you try to kind of shout it out, like you find yourself in the shower, you think about something 20 years ago and you moan.
I mean, 100%. Yeah.
So yeah, I got a few of those, and it almost always relates back to an evening. And I remember the line that just got me, you know, that got me off the radar. So yeah, it could go either way. But it is, like you say, it is invigorating, and when it goes well, oh my God, you feel so empowered. The energy that comes with it.
So rewarding. I can only begin to imagine, man. Like we did a lot of jamming. Sometimes when we're writing, of course, we do a lot of jamming. But yeah, in front of people, that's just the line that it would be interesting to cross. But man, I just feel like we'd be so bad at it that we'd drive people away.
But now you're 10, 15 years away from songs that you wrote for, like You Are the Conductor or, you know, The Four Trees. Would you consider revisiting them in a brand new light?
Absolutely. I think that's something that we've wanted to do. We just, when it comes time to put a set for tour together, it still ends up just slipping through the cracks. But yeah, that's something that would be awesome. I think that'd be really exciting. One of the things with us too is that, you know, Cal and I started the band. And then it hasn't become completely like a television show where it's like a new season and then there's a new character, but then like some of the old characters are there too. It's like, it hasn't been like a revolving door, but you know, we've brought on new members. So, you know, we've lost old members, and every time a new player sort of settles into this, like they infuse their own sensibilities into some of the old material. And that, I think maybe that's enough to make it feel like exciting and just a little bit fresh for us when we're sort of resurrecting some of that old stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it would be a blast to take something and just totally reimagine it. I think that would be awesome. And actually, thanks for the reminder, because I knew I was like sort of skimming and glossing over something here and preparing for all this touring. And like that was a good little kick in the pants to remember that. So yeah, I would love to do that, man.
You guys have the foundational perspective, the history of the band, and then you have some other members that bring in something new and totally new eyes and ears for the song. So
audiences love that stuff too. I mean, they like, especially if you're a diehard and you've been seeing a band forever, I think that almost like that encourages the audience to be creative in its own way too, because they're sort of putting some pieces together. And I love when everyone sort of converges there in the middle, when like a band is encouraging and the audience to sort of be creative in their own way. And when everyone's sort of being creative together, that's when it's kind of at the height of its powers for me, I think. So
early on, you guys had like, you know, releases like You Are the Conductor, The Four Trees, around, I want to say 2005, 2007 era. Right away, you guys went to making physical product, special edition vinyl, 100 units of one color, 200 of another. This was also the era where vinyl was not as, you know, kind of seen as cool as it is these days again. What was the band's strategy and approach to vinyl? What were the conversations in the early days about making the investment to do this, what was then a dead format?
I think, yeah. So when was it that it sort of really resurfaced and started being, you know, back in fashion again? That was like 2009-ish, 10, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
It started climbing. Yeah. We were approached by a record label around 2007 that wanted to put out one of our records on, you know, double LP. And they sort of, at the time, seemed like they had unlimited funds. They were all just obsessive vinyl collectors, the people who ran that label. And they really just gave us carte blanche to sort of, to us at the time, who, you know, appreciated the format, but weren't, like I said, you know, weren't necessarily like voracious. You know, we didn't have a huge appetite for LPs, but we respected them. I think to us, it was like, here's an opportunity to just sort of a bigger palette for the artwork. Like we can present this tactile thing to people where this artwork that, you know, we like is just, it's bigger and you can hold it. And there's, again, the ritualistic element of this whole thing. And it really brought us online with vinyl. I mean, that label, the Mylene Sheath, that roped us in with that around 2007, really kind of introduced us to that world and that lifestyle of, you know, variance. And, you know, we've obviously over the years have met just some incredibly committed collectors. And it's a beautiful place. I think it's wonderful. And we've learned throughout the years, and hopefully they get a little bit more sophisticated and we bring on designers that can really accomplish some awesome stuff. I know the packaging for this record, did you get an LP or was it just a stream that you got?
No, I got a stream, but I've ordered the LP.
Got you.
Just because you guys do the limited edition ones, so I want to get in while the getting's good.
Did you get the 180 gram maybe?
I got the 180 gram and the split one. I think it's blue and green. I got two of them.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, you know, this thing's got an OBI strip. It's got some embossing on the front, which we've never done. I mean, it's just an absolutely gorgeous package. And also anything that we can do to streaming music is wonderful. I mean, we all have Spotify accounts and, you know, we're all guilty of skimming through 30 seconds of a song and then going on to the next thing because our attention spans have been shattered along with everyone else. But anything that we can do to really, you know, foster like even just a stewardship of listening to music and sort of hearkening back to that time when people would sit around with the record player smoking a joint and just like relax, you know what I mean? And really make it an event. I think vinyl is a format that obviously lends itself to that better than any format out there. And anything that we can do to sort of encourage that and foster that within the listener is something that we're going to chase. So vinyl is the number one like gatekeeper there. Like that's that sort of point of entry. If you can get someone wrapped around that format, I think then they're going to invest themselves into what they're listening to. They're going to invest, you know, they're going to make it much more of a point. And that's awesome. That's how we want our records to be received. I think every band wants their records to be received that way, you know.
The Caspian music really lends itself to, you know, the requirement to pay attention. And, you know, vinyl is obviously a great format for that. I saw you also did the record release party in a planetarium, which...
That was so fucking awesome, man. Yeah.
So tell us about that and what was being projected while that was happening.
I'm sure there's lots of these planetariums at, you know, many museums of sciences out there across the world. In Boston, we have one called the Hayden Planetarium. And probably like most of them, it's this sort of huge dome screen. And you sit on these, you know, super comfortable movie chairs and you're not fully reclined, but you're pretty much halfway. And back in high school, you know, Cal and I would go to, you know, we'd go see the Pink Floyd laser show on Friday nights or the Zeppelin laser show on Fridays at the planetarium. And everyone would come in there just like reeking of weed and stuff. And like people would just be dropping acid. And it was like a wild environment, but it was really immersive and it was really exciting and it was an event. So we've always kind of wanted to recreate that and do an album launch, with the people down at the planetarium. So we started hatching that plan, I want to say two or three months ago. They have a really amazing staff of super committed people who do events like this. They mostly do live events. So they'll have a band come into the planetarium and then project visuals above them while they're playing. We really wanted to just press play on the record. So yeah, they had an in-house guy who's just an absolute, you know, a whiz, a total genius. And he sort of lived with the record for a month. And, you know, it looks like from his final product, it's like he just must have spent 24 hours a day putting this together. I mean, it was perfectly synced up with the music. You know, there was some Cosmos stuff and then there was some like psychedelic stuff. And then there was like, one of the songs featured lasers, which we really wanted. And that was just really like very retro and it was awesome, but we really just gave him free rein to, again, to sort of hopefully, you know, encourage some kind of creativity from him. And man, he totally killed it. So that was quite an experience. You know, we did two screenings of it. The first one, the 7 o'clock one, we got in there for a sound check and we wanted the volume up a little bit overall because, you know, it was a listening party as well as a viewing thing. And I think something happened in between our sound check and the first screening where like the volume for the 7 o'clock one of the record was just like, I mean, the absolute loudest thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, you know, so, you know, if you turn a stereo on and it's accidentally at full blast and you're like, oh shit, and you go to turn it down.
Yeah.
It was like that. Was it distorting? It was like that for like almost, I don't like some of the highs were a little compromised. But it was like, it was fucking intense. Like it was peeling the skin off people's faces and, it was exciting. That was also like talk about just like a raw random moment. But damn, I mean, I heard things at that volume that I forgot I had recorded on the album, and it was really exciting. So the 9 o'clock when we tempered it and reined it in a little. But yeah, that was great. That was a lot of fun, and I hope we get to do something like that again. You know, it'd be cool to just get it out to other planetariums, and like if they could just sort of fold it into their programming, that would be awesome. But yeah, we'll see.
Well, I hope that happens because I'd absolutely love to have that experience of hearing the new album in a planetarium. Again, I want to remind the audience, Caspian on Circles is available now. You can check it out streaming, Apple, Spotify, all those sorts of places, but grab yourself a physical copy at caspianband.com. We'll put links in the episode page. Of course, also check them out on tour. They're touring the United States throughout the first half of 2020 and hopefully beyond in the second half of the year. Love to see you guys in Australia at some point. And of course, I'm sure you'll be hitting Europe and all the other hot spots shortly thereafter. Again, everyone, check out the new Caspian album, On Circles, limited vinyl pressings. I've been tweeting and sharing about these to our audience as soon as I saw their availability. They may be gone by now, but if not, grab one quick. Phil, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. A real pleasure, man.
There we go. Philip Jameson of Caspian. What a nice guy. What a fantastic band. I can't highly recommend them enough. Is that the right way to say it? I can't recommend them highly enough. Whatever. It's a long day. I'm tired. Go to caspian.band. See them on tour. Pick up the new record, On Circles. It's brilliant. You won't regret it. Alrighty, well, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading. Make sure to share with your friends. Share this on social media. Tweet it to different folks. Put it on Instagram. Tell a friend. Call a stranger. Even seek out your enemies and make peace with them by telling them about The Vinyl Guide podcast. That's how we grow the community, and I really do appreciate your listenership. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.